Then there were 100 other details. Some of them concerned how he should present Salander in the articles. To make the ultimate decision, he needed to have a personal conversation to get her approval to tell the truth, or at least parts of it. And he could not have that conversation because she was under arrest, and no visitors were allowed. In that respect, his sister was no help either. She followed the regulations slavishly and had no intention of acting as Blomqvist's go-between. Nor did Giannini tell him anything about what she and her client discussed, other than the parts that concerned the conspiracy against her. Giannini needed help with those. It was frustrating, but all very correct. Consequently, Blomqvist had no clue whether Salander had revealed that her previous guardian had raped her, or that she had taken revenge by tattooing a shocking message on his stomach. As long as Giannini did not mention the matter, neither could he. But Salander's being isolated presented one other acute problem. She was a computer expert and a hacker, which Blomqvist knew, but Giannini did not. Blomqvist had promised Salander that he would never reveal her secret, and he had kept his promise. But now he had a great need for her skills in that field. Somehow he had to establish contact with her. He sighed as he opened Olsen's folder again. There was a photocopy of a passport application form for one Idris Gidi, born 1950, a man with a moustache, olive skin, and black hair going grey at the temples. He was Kurdish, a refugee from Iraq. Olsen had dug up much more on Gidi than on any other hospital worker. Gidi had apparently aroused media attention for a time and had appeared in several articles. Born in the city of Mosul, in northern Iraq, he graduated as an engineer and had been part of the Great Economic Leap Forward in the 70s. In 1984, he was a teacher at the College of Construction Technology in Mosul. He had not been known as a political activist, but he was a Kurd, and so a potential criminal in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. In 1987, Gidi's father was arrested on suspicion of being a Kurdish militant. No elaboration was forthcoming. He was executed in January 1988. 3 months later, Idris Gidi was seized by the Iraqi secret police, taken to a prison outside Mosul, and tortured there for 11 months to make him confess. What he was expected to confess, Gidi never discovered, so the torture continued. In March 1989, one of Gidi's uncles paid the equivalent of 50,000 Swedish kronor to the local leader of the Ba'ath Party as compensation for the injury Gidi had caused the Iraqi state. 2 days later, he was released into his uncle's custody. He weighed 86 pounds and was unable to walk. Before his release, his left hip was smashed with a sledgehammer to discourage any mischief in the future. He hovered between life and death for several weeks. When, slowly, he began to recover, his uncle took him to a farm well away from Mosul, and there, over the summer, his strength returned and he was eventually able to walk again with crutches. He would never regain full health. The question was, what was he going to do in the future? In August, he learned that his two brothers had been arrested. He would never see them again. When his uncle heard that Saddam Hussein's police were looking once more for Gidi, he arranged, for a fee equivalent to 30,000 kronor, to get him across the border into Turkey, and from there, with a false passport, to Europe. Idris Gidi landed at Arlanda Airport in Sweden on October 19, 1989. He did not know a word of Swedish, but he had been told to go to the passport police and immediately to ask for political asylum, which he did in broken English. He was sent to a refugee camp in Upplands Väsby. There he would spend almost 2 years, until the immigration authorities decided that Gidi did not have sufficient grounds for a residency permit. By this time, Gidi had learned Swedish and obtained treatment for his shattered hip. He had 2 operations and could now walk without crutches. During that period, the Sjöbo debate had been conducted in Sweden. Refugee camps had been attacked, and Bert Karlsson had formed the New Democracy Party. The reason why Gidi had appeared so frequently in the press archives was that at the 11th hour he got a new lawyer who went directly to the press, and they published reports on his case. Other Kurds in Sweden got involved, including members of the prominent Baksi family. Protest meetings were held and petitions were sent to Minister of Immigration Birgit Friggebo, with the result that Gidi was granted both a residency permit and a work visa in the Kingdom of Sweden. In January 1992, he left Upplands Väsby a free man. Gidi soon discovered that being a well-educated and experienced construction engineer counted for nothing. He worked as a newspaper boy, a dishwasher, a doorman, and a taxi driver. He liked being a taxi driver except for two things. He had no local knowledge of the streets in Stockholm County, and he could not sit still for more than an hour before the pain in his hip became unbearable. In May 1998, he moved to Göteborg, after a distant relative who owned an office cleaning firm took pity on him. He was given a job on a cleaning crew at Sahlgrenska Hospital, with which the company had a contract. The work was routine. He swabbed floors 6 days a week, including, as Olsen's ferreting had revealed, Corridor 11C. Blomqvist studied the photograph of Idris Gidi from the passport application. Then he logged onto the media archive and picked out several of the articles on which Olsen's report was based. He read attentively. He lit a cigarette. The smoking ban at Millennium had been relaxed soon after Berger left. Cortez now kept an ashtray on his desk. Finally, Blomqvist read what Olsen had produced about Dr. Anders Jonasson.